For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, you know, 1 Peter 2 and 3. This is a letter written in 60 AD from Peter to struggling Christians. The topic that he's been taking up here in these chapters is how should Christians interact with a hostile world? You know, this was a society that was persecuting them for their beliefs. And we saw some of the difficult situations that they found themselves in. And we've looked at how to deal with those over the past couple of studies. Peter's been saying this whole time, you've got to do it with kindness. You've got to do it with love. You've got to do it with good deeds. Live morally excellent lives, he says in chapter 2. So that even when they slander you, they'll change their minds and they'll feel kind of bad that they're being really mean to you and you're loving them back. And so that's what, you know, we read this last week. He says to sum up, be harmonious, living in harmony together with one another and with non-believers. He says sympathetic, so there's not an arrogance but an understanding, trying to understand the other person's situation, where they're coming from, brotherly love toward one another, kind-hearted, humble in spirit, not an arrogant, know-it-all sort of thing when it comes to sharing about reasons for belief, but a real humble spirit, self-effacing, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead, not retaliating like the rest of the world does. And like Peter says, like you guys used to do before you met Christ, you've received his grace. And now that should result in treating other people with grace. Because you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. We're actually blessed as we love other people, as we turn the other cheek, as Jesus taught. He says, you know, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? You know, if you're zealous to be kind and humble and empathetic and non-retaliatory, he says, who is really going to be coming after you if you're living that kind of a life? And he says, and even if they do come after you, even if you should suffer for doing the right thing for the sake of righteousness, you're blessed. That's what Jesus did. And don't fear their intimidation, and don't be troubled. And so he's trying to comfort them and speak to these real pastoral concerns that they had. And yet, Peter says that it's not just enough to have the subjective elements of our witness. It's not enough just to have love and kindness and good deeds. Your lifestyle is necessary just to gain a hearing. You know, Christianity should work. Any worldview that you're going to hold to should work. It should produce a good result in your life. But it's not enough on its own. You also need to offer truth. You need to come with reasons. And that's what he addresses in the next verse. In verse 15, he says, but sanctify or set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. So you see, you still have the subjective elements, the kindness, gentleness, reverence, respect. But he says, you know, what you need to do here, first of all, is you need to set apart Christ as Lord in your heart. And so there's a heart attitude that needs to come with successful witnessing, telling people about Jesus. And, you know, in your heart of hearts, you know, the real question is, who am I trying to please? And if you're trying to please other people, then, you know, it's probably safer, quote unquote, and not as scary just to keep your head down, to keep quiet, and just to try to blend in. You know, they were risking getting further persecution by speaking up. And Peter's like, look, you've got to set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts. You know, you've got to be seeking to please God rather than men. You've got to have your mind totally focused on the mission that Christ gave us, which is to tell people about the forgiveness that he offers. And so you've got to set him apart as Lord if you're going to be successful in telling people the truth. Otherwise, you're going to bend the truth to what the other person really wants to hear. And he says you always have to be ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you. An account, the reasons for the hope that is in you. You know, a lot of people are surprised to realize that Christian belief has a rational basis. You know, faith in a lot of people's minds, it's to believe something in spite of evidence to the contrary. And yet when we come to Christianity, we see that there is a rational basis. He says to give a reason for the hope that is in you, to give a defense. You know, that word defense is like the kind of thing you would give in a courtroom. Like if you're being examined by a lawyer or something like that, it's like, you know, here's the case and you're a witness that's called to testify. And what are you going to do? Are you going to be ready to take the stand or not? That's what Peter says. And, you know, it kind of raises this question here because the notion of faith is such a watered-down notion. You know, what is a good reason for believing in something? Let's consider, you know, should you believe something because that's what everyone else believes? Is that a good reason to believe something? You know, I doubt that that many people would say yes to this, although, you know, people will be like, well, you know, some people grew up in this part of the world, and that's why they're Muslim, and other people grew up in this part of the world, and that's why they're Hindu, and other people grew up in this part of the world, and that's why they're Christian. I think we should just, you know, leave well enough alone, and, you know, that's what's right for them, because that's the way they were raised. Really? So we should just believe whatever the people around us believe? You know, what if we lived in a culture that believed the world was flat? Should we believe that? What if we lived in a culture, what if we were raised in an area that believed that our race is superior to races of a different color, of a different ethnicity? Is that something we should believe? No. It's not an adequate basis for belief, just because, you know, this is the way I was raised or what everybody around me believes. What about because your parents told you to? Well, that's kind of a variant of that first one, right? If you think about it, though, I mean, how many of us believe what our parents believe? How many of us have different beliefs, at least in some way, than what our parents believe? I know I sure do. I know my parents do for their parents. And I bet most of us here would say, no, I actually do have some different beliefs than what my parents told me to believe. I've kind of decided on my own what I believe. Is it a good reason to believe in something because it makes you feel better? Some people might say, you know, faith, you know, you just got to have faith in whatever you believe, like those are two different things or something. And you just need to believe what feels right. That's faith. And that's how you should decide what you believe. Well, you know, there's problems with that view as well. I mean, it probably would make me feel pretty good if I could convince myself that I had $10 million in my bank account. I would probably feel pretty good, at least for a little while, until I started writing checks like I had $10 million in that bank account. And then I might not feel so good after a little bit of that. And so to believe something just because it makes me feel better is not an adequate basis for belief, and that is not biblical faith. You know, if you're a Christian just because, you know, believing in Jesus makes you feel good, that's a terrible reason for belief, and that is in direct violation of what Peter is talking about here, where you need to be ready to give a defense, to give a reason, an account for why you have the hope in you. Is it because it makes me feel good? No, not good enough. Some people think, well, you know, it's kind of this idea that faith actually causes something to happen. And actually, as I believe in God, that it actually, like, you know, builds God up in some way, or that God needs me to believe in Him, or because I believe in God, then that's you know, whatever I believe, that's what's true. And, you know, I was thinking about, this is actually a pretty popular definition of faith, and I was thinking about that as I was watching this Christmas movie last week. I don't know how many people have seen this movie here. But, you know, one of the main premises of the movie is that people don't believe in Santa anymore. And that's how Santa's sleigh used to fly. And as belief in Santa waned, that's when they made the Kringle 3000 engine. And, you know, at the end of the movie, Buddy the Elf gets everybody to believe in Santa again, and so Santa can fly and deliver presents and stuff. But, you know, it's really, this is the heart of what a lot of people think faith is. It's, you know, I believe in this, and that's what makes it true. And it's almost like the thing I believe in really needs me to believe in it. And that's faith. And that's unfortunately how a lot of people approach religion and matters of faith, is it's just, I believe it and therefore it's true. And frankly, a God that needs me to believe in Him, I don't know if I want to put my trust in a God like that anyway. It seems kind of like a needy God. Should you believe something because it works? A pragmatic view of faith? Well, the problem with this, you know, I mean, obviously a worldview should work. It should actually fit and be livable. And if it's not livable, if it doesn't work, then that might be reason to cast that aside. That could be disqualifying. But just because something seems to work, is that a reason to believe it? I mean, part of the problem is it's kind of hard to tell at first if it's working or not. You know, take, for example, my belief that, you know, I've got $10 million in my bank account. That might work for a little while. You know, that might give me more confidence. It might make me happier. But at a certain point, that's going to stop working. And it might be after I've already made a lot of mistakes and gone down way too far down that path. And when it comes to the kind of things, the stakes that the Bible talks about, where your eternal destiny is on the line, you know, it's like just trying something out to see if it works. That might not be enough. And you might find out too late that worldview did not work. I've got a different idea about what's a good reason to believe in something. We should believe in something because it's true. And, you know, my job as someone that can believe in things, all right, I have that power, a choice to believe, right? My job is to try to figure out what is true and then put my faith or my belief, I'm basically using those interchangeably, put my faith in that. And that would be the best possible criteria that something could have for me to believe in it. And that's the Bible's view of faith. That's the Bible's view of belief. It's, you should believe in this because it's true and because this is what corresponds to reality. But you know, reasons, when it comes to biblical faith, reasons alone are not enough. It doesn't get you there. You know, when you look at biblical faith, you know, it starts with reasons. And I'm going to give you some reasons here. I mean, Peter says you need to be able to give some reasons for the hope in you. I'm going to give some reasons that I like tonight. Reasons that I turn back to again and again. But those reasons alone are not enough. You know, that reason has to be, you've got to take the next step and you've got to actually believe. You've got to place your belief in that. And it's an act of the will. It's a decision to believe these things that seem to have a good probability of being true. You know, another thing I'm going to argue is that you can't be 100% certain of anything, at least not of any worldview. But what you're looking at is which is the most probable explanation of reality, of what I see. What's the worldview that most likely matches up to reality, and I should place my belief in that. And then from there, I have an experience. You know, I believe enough even to take action, to act on those reasons. You know, just sit there with your arms folded and say, not enough, not enough, not enough, but to never act on it. That's not biblical faith. And the experience, the confirming experience that's going to follow that is not going to happen either. There's got to be a step of faith that you take. It's got to be some sort of action that you take based on these beliefs. Again, you know, let's take the bank account example again. You know, imagine there is $10 million in my bank account, and I'm like, I don't believe you. And I'm just skeptical, and you're like, look, here's your bank statement. Look, let's go down. We'll take 1,000 out just to show you that your balance went down to 99999, okay? I'd be like, I don't believe you, don't believe it, you know. It's not until I believe that enough to go out and start to spend some of that money that I get that confirming experience to see that my credit card is not declined, that they don't come and take all of my stuff away. That's when I start to actually believe that, even though it seems too good to be true. And so, reason. You know, you may be called to testify at any time. The apologia is that word to make a defense. That's where we get the word apologetics, which is just a Christian term for defending the faith. But it's to give a defense, and it's used in courtroom settings, even in the New Testament. You might be called to testify at any time, for one, to non-Christians. In fact, this is the mission Christ has given his followers, to tell people about him. And it's not just to non-Christians, though. You know, it's even to yourself and other Christians, too. I think apologetics are just as good, if not better, for answering your own doubts. You know, these doubts are going to come up in your mind. And when those doubts come up, you've got to have a place to turn. You've got to have, you know, your mind's got to go somewhere. You know, I really don't have doubts in any real sense anymore. You know, there was a time in my Christian walk where I did, but I feel like I am so convinced now, and I've been over this list so many times, you know, different reasons to believe, as well as my memories of the experiences that line up with those beliefs, that doubt is really not something I have to struggle with anymore. But, you know, there's going to be people around you that struggle with doubt, and maybe you even struggle with that. And so you're going to need some place to turn to convince your mind. You can't just be like, la, 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 you know, when you have doubts. That's going to catch up with you. That's eroding the basis for your beliefs, and your beliefs going to get weaker and weaker. You're going to become less and less convinced, whether you like it or not, of Christianity, and you may end up losing your faith at some point. And so I think these are pretty helpful. Our case that I'm going to lay out here this evening, I'm going to give you multiple lines of evidence, not just one single airtight proof or anything like that. There is no proof. There's evidence. It's a probability case. And none of these are inescapable. You know, any one of them or even several of them, you can be like, well, what about this and what about that? And no, I'm still not convinced. You know, none of these are going to force you to believe. That still is a choice that God leaves for you. Are you going to believe? Are you going to take that step of faith and to get the real confirming experience? That's where your real certainty comes from. It's as you step out in faith. People that never take action on their faith, their faith is becomes more and more theoretical. They have more and more doubt, and it's because they're not acting on it. Jesus said, if you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. And so that blessing comes into our lives as we act. Together, though, I think they are highly persuasive. You know, I like the analogy of a rope where, you know, as you take a piece of rope and you might feel, okay, that's pretty strong, but maybe you could break that rope. Then you take another piece of similar thickness and you wind it around that rope. Then you take another and you wind it around that rope. Then you take another and another, and by, you know, pretty soon you've got a rope that's that thick. It's going to take a pretty significant amount of weight to break. And that's what we have in Christianity, and that's what we have tonight that I'm going to lay out for you, is arguments. And each one you can kind of think of like another strand around a piece of rope to make a stronger and stronger case for biblical Christianity. And so, like I said, these are just some of the different reasons that I go back to, used to go back to, and still go back to sometimes when I've had doubts, and also that I share with other people whenever I get the opportunity. The first is a category I'm going to call arguments from science. I've got three categories, and I'm not going to talk too much about the second one. Arguments from science, though. We've got three sub-arguments under this one. First of all is one called the fine-tuning argument. Fine-tuning argument. I like how Stephen Hawking presents this in his book, A Brief History of Time. He says, the laws of science, as we know them at present, contain many fundamental numbers, like the size of the electric charge of the electron and the ratio of the masses of the proton and the electron. We cannot, at the moment at least, predict the values of these numbers from theory. We have to find them from observation. So they can't just perform a series of calculations and figure out, okay, well, this has to be, you know, this constant here. They just test it, and they do it enough times to the point where they've got a really precise figure for that particular constant. He says, the remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. For example, if the electric charge of the electron had only been slightly different, stars either would have been unable to burn hydrogen and helium, or else they would not have exploded. I bet you were wondering that earlier today. I wonder if the electric charge of the electron, what would happen if that was different? Well, Hawking says life would not have been able to exist on Earth. You know, you wouldn't think a minor change like that would make that much of a difference. It seems clear that there are relatively few ranges of values for the numbers that would allow the development of any form of intelligent life. Most sets of values would give rise to universes that, although they might be very beautiful, would contain no one able to wonder at that beauty. Hawking, not a Christian. Brilliant man, not a Christian. Paul Davies, agnostic, who's done a lot of writing on this subject. He says, he gives an example of one of these numbers. He says, had the explosion of the Big Bang differed in strength at the outset by only one part in 10 to the 60th, the universe we perceive would not exist. One part in 10 to the 60th, okay? That's a one with 60 zeros behind it. That's a lot. The numbers involved here are so astronomical that part of the literature on this is just giving analogies trying to help us to understand the size of these numbers. To give some meaning to these numbers, suppose you wanted to fire a bullet at a one-inch target on the other side of the observable universe, 20 billion light years away. Your aim would have to be accurate to that same part in 10 to the 60th. That's a pretty sharp shot there. Powerful gun, too. Hugh Ross, Christian astrophysicist, he says, okay, let's take one of these. So, you know, some of the smaller ones, some of the smaller numbers on this, one part in 10 to the 37 is one of the more generous ranges that these numbers have. He's trying to explain one of the ones that have more tolerance. He says, one part in 10 to the 37 is such an incredibly sensitive balance that it's hard to visualize. The following analogy might help. Cover the entire North American continent. Okay, so we're talking like, you know, Panama up through the part of Canada nobody ever goes to. Cover that whole thing with dimes. All the way to the moon, a height of 239,000 miles. That's a lot of dimes. Here's a little visual, okay? There's Earth. Here's the moon. There's your dimes. He says, in comparison, the money to pay for the U.S. federal government debt would cover one square mile less than 2 feet deep with dimes. And that tells you something right there. Next, pile dimes from here to the moon on a billion other continents the same size as North America, because A single North America piled with dimes to the moon is not enough. You need a billion North Americas piled with dimes to the moon. He goes on to say, paint one dime red, toss it in there, and mix the whole thing up, okay? You've got pile of 10 to the 37 dimes, a billion North Americas piled to the moon with dimes. Paint one dime red, and then, put a blindfold on and rummage through those dimes, and then just pick one at random and hold it up. Did you pick the red dime? If so, then that's the likelihood that this one particular number he's talking about would be the right value. And that's the range that you've got for that particular constant. It's remarkably precise, these different numbers. And there's not just one of these, the speed of expansion from the Big Bang is 1 part 10 to the 55th. Imagine this is your range. It zeroes right in on that speed of expansion of the Big Bang. But the strength of gravity has a range of tolerance here of 1 part in 10 to the 40. And wouldn't you know, that's exactly the value of the strength of gravity. The mass of the universe had a range of 1 part in 10 to the 59th. But wouldn't you know it, that's exactly the value of that constant for our universe. The ratio of electrons to protons, 1 part in 10 to the 37th. Wouldn't you know that ratio was exactly right? And you can go on this way, drawing line after line, and every single one of these, up over 30 lines, according to Paul Davies, again, not a Christian, have lined up with exactly the right value for life to exist. It's as though somebody was up at some sort of cosmic switchboard with a bunch of dials and was adjusting each one exactly to where it needed to be for life to exist here on this planet. You don't realize how incredibly unusual this is, how unlikely this is. His book is called Cosmic Jackpot, and that's kind of a description of how he views what's happened here in this world. Against all odds, we hit the jackpot, and we can actually have life here. In fact, Francis Collins, he's a geneticist, head of the Human Genome Project. In his book, The Language of God, he points to this specific argument as the thing that pushed him over the edge to become a believer in Christ. He says, the chance that all these constants would take on the values necessary to result in a stable universe capable of sustaining complex life forms is almost infinitesimal. And yet, those are exactly the parameters that we observe. In sum, our universe is wildly improbable. In fact, human language cannot describe how improbable this universe is. And yet everything is set up just right. It's almost like there was someone who set things up so life could exist here. That's an argument I find pretty satisfying as a Christian believer. There's also the Big Bang. This is the notion that it doesn't even look at what happened after the universe started, but just the fact that the universe started. Again, Hawking, he says almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. John Barrow of Cambridge, agnostic, he says at this singularity, he doesn't say at this time, because that's when time began to exist. He says at this singularity, space and time came into existence. Literally, nothing existed before the singularity. So, if the universe originated at such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo, or out of nothing. The singularity is to be regarded as the boundary of space-time. Well, what brought this into existence? What started all of this? If it wasn't something natural, could it have been something supernatural? I've read explanations where people are attempting to explain how this started, if not for some sort of a creator, and I find them pretty unsatisfying. Is it possible that there's actually a creator that set all of this into motion? And then is it possible that that creator has also tried to communicate with us? There's also the origin and complexity of life. That's another one that I think is remarkable. And, I'm not like a young Earth creationist. I think the Earth is older than 6,000 years old. But when you look at life, when you look at, just what's happening at a cellular level, it's pretty amazing what's going on in each one of your cells at this very moment. I've got a short video, live footage from inside of your cells of DNA translation and transcription, so.
Ooh. What you are about to see is DNA's most extraordinary secret. How a simple code is turned into flesh and blood. It begins with a bundle of factors assembling at the start of a gene. A gene is simply a length of DNA instructions stretching away to the left. The assembled factors trigger the first phase of the process, reading off the information that will be needed to make the protein. Everything is ready to roll. 3, 2, 1, go. The blue molecule racing along the DNA is reading the gene. It's unzipping the double helix and copying one of the two strands. The yellow chain snaking out of the top is a copy of the genetic message, and it's made of a close chemical cousin of DNA, called RNA. The building blocks to make the RNA enter through an intake hole. They are matched to the DNA, letter by letter, to copy the A's, C's, T's, and G's of the gene. The only difference is that in the RNA copy, the letter T is replaced with a closely related building block known as U. You are watching this process called transcription in real time. It's happening right now in almost every cell in your body.
Real time. All right, I got another one now. Translation.
When the RNA copy is complete, it snakes out into the outer part of the cell. Then, in a dazzling display of choreography, all the components of a molecular machine lock together around the RNA to form a miniature factory called a ribosome. It translates the genetic information in the RNA into a string of amino acids that will become a protein. Special transfer molecules, the green triangles, bring each amino acid to the ribosome. The amino acids are the small red tips attached to the transfer molecules. There are different transfer molecules for each of the 20 amino acids. Each transfer molecule carries a three-letter code that is matched with the RNA in the machine. Now we come to the heart of the process. Inside the ribosome, the RNA is pulled through like a tape. The code for each amino acid is read off, three letters at a time, and matched to three corresponding letters on the transfer molecules. When the right transfer molecule plugs in, the amino acid it carries is added to the growing protein chain. Again, you are watching this in real time. And after a few seconds, the assembled protein starts to emerge from the ribosome. Ribosomes can make any kind of protein. It just depends what genetic message you feed in on the RNA. In this case, the end product is hemoglobin. The cells in our bone marrow churn out 100 trillion molecules of it per second. And as a result, our muscles, brain, and all the vital organs in our body receive the oxygen they need.
Trillion molecules of hemoglobin per second. And you thought you were just sitting there. A good friend of mine was in a biology class as a non-Christian and was looking at studies like this, and she was just like, check please, you know, there's no way. There's got to be something else out there, and went on, started to actually seek to try to find. Remember, some people are like, well, that's Darwinian evolution that got us there. Before Darwinian evolution can happen, you need organisms that can both maintain life and reproduce. Until you've got reproduction, evolution does not take effect. How did all that begin in the first place? Or anything that could live and reproduce without evolution? Evolution can only explain what happened, the selection process, once things can make more of itself And it weeds out, you know, the weaker parts and favors the stronger species. Anthony Flew, ex-atheist philosopher, was one of the most famous atheists of the 20th century till the 21st century when he converted to theism. Not Christianity, but theism. His book is called There Is a God. Here's what he says. He says, although I was once sharply critical of the argument to design, I've since come to see that when correctly formatted, this argument constitutes a persuasive case for the existence of God. You know, it's just the advances in knowledge over, you know, several decades were just too much for him to handle, and he did end up becoming a theist before he died a couple years ago, 2 years ago. I think that's pretty persuasive stuff, the arguments from science. There's also arguments from history, which I'm not going to be able to go into, but there's two of the most persuasive are predictive prophecy, where things about Jesus and other things about the future were predicted long in advance with great specificity in the Bible, and then they came to pass. In addition to that, there's Jesus' resurrection, which a strong case can be made that he did rise from the dead. I don't have time to go into these arguments. I wish we could spend several weeks on every single thing I'm talking about here tonight. Everything here is beyond the scope of this discussion. I want to talk about some arguments from common sense, though. Bear with me here. Common sense or intuition. These are things that deep down we know to be true. I want you to imagine a world that's governed only by natural processes. Okay, consider the atheist or the naturalist account. And so, you know, there is no God, there is no supernatural, there's just the natural world. What would a world like that look like? You know, you can imagine a chemical reaction such as putting baking soda in a cup and then pouring vinegar in there. You know, that's a natural, physical, chemical reaction. You know, you've got a certain amount of vinegar, a certain amount of baking soda. You combine those two. You could predict in advance exactly how much gas that would give off and what would be left at the end. You could repeat this experiment over and over again. And you're going to get the same reaction every time. This is determinism. This is the notion that there are laws that the universe follows. Natural laws. The question then becomes, if that's all that there is, what are the implications for humanity? What are the implications for human beings? You know, and it helps to put kind of a face on this, all right? You know, you've got your chemical reaction here, but I think it helps put kind of a personal face on this, and I'm going to use the face of Pat Reeder. He said I could use this. Now, many of us know Pat. What is Pat, though? You know, I mean, is Pat just, you know, a bunch of natural processes? I mean, we know that he's a PhD student at OSU. We know we can look on Rate My Professor and see that he's a good teacher, and he also has the coveted hot tamale rating. But, you know, according to naturalism, what's going on inside of his brain? Well, it's this. Chemical reactions, a series of chemical reactions. Pat and every single one of us here, we are nothing more than a series of chemical reactions. What you think is you is not you. You know, that's some sort of a false concept that, you know, has been created inside the whatever's going on inside your brain. And it's not you. You don't have an identity. You know, we can ask this question, is there anything special about humans? What makes humans different than anything else, any other matter? You know, what's the difference between a 150-pound human and a 150-pound bag of dead flies? You know, they're both about the same size, I don't know. They both weigh the same amount. You know, what really is the difference? You know, it might be a little bit more calcium in the human. You get some bones, a little more, you know, structure. But, you know, just from analyzing matter, you know, they're actually equivalent in a lot of ways. What makes a human being different than a bug? You know, why is it that I would have no problem swatting a mosquito, and yet crushing a human would be unthinkable? And I would be arrested rightly and thrown into prison for that. Under the naturalistic view, there is no explanation for that. Am I really me? Or am I just a series of chemical reactions? You know, when you think I did this or I'm going to do that, what does that even mean? What do you mean when you say I? What do you mean when you say you? Do I have freedom to choose, or are my choices determined by physical laws? That's another problem here, you know. Under determinism, you know, just like it's not like, you know, a piece of paper falling to the ground. Is that right or wrong? Did it have any choice in whether it was going to do that? It had no choice. That's not a moral act. That's non-moral. And so the choices that we make, if it's just the chemical reactions, how much control do we even have over what happens there? Is there such a thing as right and wrong? If I don't have the ability to choose one thing or the other, if whatever happens, happens, according to predefined natural laws, different forces interacting with one another, then, you know, who are we to say that that's right or that's wrong in the sense that we usually mean it? And does what I call love mean anything? What is love under this definition? Again, it's just a series of chemical reactions. And under the naturalist worldview, is there anything special about humans? No. Am I really me? No. Do I have freedom to choose? No. Is there such a thing as right and wrong? No. And does what I love mean anything? Does what I call love mean anything? No. No, no, no. Here's Sam Harris, atheist philosopher and writer. Free will is an illusion. Our wills are simply not of our own making. Thoughts and intentions emerge from background causes of which we are unaware and over which we exert no conscious control. We do not have the freedom we think we have. He just plainly admits it. No, we don't have freedom. We are physical, material collections that are just interacting with our surroundings. Stephen Hawking, again, he says the molecular basis of biology shows that biological processes are governed by the laws of physics and chemistry, and therefore are as determined as the orbits of the planets. So it seems that we are no more than biological machines and that free will is just an illusion. Our thinking is as fixed as the orbits of the planets. We are biological machines. That's the naturalistic worldview. Paul Davies, a few years ago, Stephen Hawking summed up scientists' prevailing attitude toward the status of life in the universe. And you know what he said? The human race is just a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. That's how he put it. Most physicists and cosmologists would echo Hawking and regard life as a trivial, accidental embellishment to the physical world of no particular significance in the overall cosmic scheme of things. Michael Gazzaniga says, nowhere in the animal kingdom does such creativity or cooperation between unrelated individuals exist. He's talking about how remarkable the human race is. He's perhaps even more amazing is that there are people who do not see much difference in the abilities of humans and that of other animals. It's like, we're just like chimps, but just a little smarter. A little smarter than dolphins. He says, humans have spread across the world and live in hugely varying environments. Meanwhile, our closest living relatives, the chimps, are endangered. Why don't they start farming or something like that? Why don't they develop technology? We can solve problems that no other animal can solve. The only possible answer is that this came about because we have something that they do not. Susan Blackmore, atheist, psychologist. Here's what she says about our sense of self. We can reject any persisting entity that corresponds to our feeling of being a self. Am I me? She's like, no, you're not. The trouble is that it's very hard to accept in one's own personal life, too. It means taking a radically different view of every experience. You see, we think that you think you're you. You think you have free will. You think there is such a thing as right and wrong. You think that, that love really means something. You think that there is a difference between a human being and that couch over there, and that one is more valuable than the other, significantly more so. It means accepting that there is no one who's having these experiences. That's what you got to get through your head. No one is experiencing what you think you're experiencing. It means accepting that every time I seem to exist, this is just a temporary fiction and not the same me who seemed to exist a moment before or last week or last year. When you say last week I went to the store, that's not true. You know how many millions of cells have recycled since that time? They say every cell recycles every 5 to 7 years. And so to say, you know, back in third grade, you're already talking nonsense. Because there's nothing left of you from third grade if you're just a physical being. Now, if there's a non-physical part of you, if there's a spiritual part of you, if there's a mind, if there's a ghost in the machine, as one person put it, if there's something non-material, that runs things, then yeah, you can say I, because that part of you is not subject to, fading away or perishing. That part's eternal, according to the Bible. She says, you know, this is tough, but I think it gets easier with practice. Deluding yourself into thinking you're not even you. Even if free will is technically an illusion, it's a very powerful illusion. And so the feeling of being free carries on, even for people who no longer believe it's true. Such people sometimes say they live as if free will existed, and as if they and others had selves. That way they can live honestly without believing in something they know cannot possibly be true. For others, the feeling finally disappears. That's what I call an unlivable worldview. That's what I call a worldview that goes against every ounce of common sense and intuition that God gave us. Francis Schaeffer, a Christian author and philosopher, says, to say I'm only a machine is one thing. To live consistently as if this were true is quite another. The very mannishness of man, he calls it, or humanishness of humans, refuses to live in the logic of the position to which his humanism and rationalism has brought him. It's like we're doing an equation that factors God out of every step, and then we get to the final conclusion where we have to live our lives, and we can't do it. Although man may say he's no more than a machine, his whole life denies it. Completely unlivable. At what point are you just confused or dishonest? Some of us had never thought about this stuff before. I know I sure had not before I became a Christian. But there comes a point where you got to admit, you got to grapple with these issues, or just admit, I don't want God to be there. It's just suppressing the truth in unrighteousness, is what the Apostle Paul calls it. Like trying to push a beach ball underwater. And it keeps popping back up, even though you're telling yourself with all your might, I'm not a self, I'm a machine. And yet, you can't live life that way. Doug Grutheis on morality. He says, under individual relativism, the autonomous self becomes the moral legislator. That means individual relativism, that's where you're left with, I guess I'm the one to decide what's right and wrong if there's no God. And I'm the moral legislator. I'm the one that determines right and wrong. There's no rational basis for moral agreement or moral disagreement since the self is supreme. You think that's right, I think this is right. Who am I to tell you you're wrong? Just as we cannot argue that vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate, since our evaluation is purely subjective, which I would disagree, actually. I think chocolate's better. So we cannot argue that Nazi experimentation or torture is any better or worse than Huguenot's rescue of Jewish children from such a fate, a story he had told earlier in this chapter. I mean, what's the difference? It's just like, as one author put it, it's like the difference between, do I want to play the trumpet or the trombone? It's just a choice that you make. You decide. Richard Dawkins, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Michael Ruse, another atheist, says morality is a biological adaptation, no less than our hands and feet and teeth. It's something that evolved over time. It's like helped the survival of our species, but that's all it is. It's not real in some sort of out there sense. He says, the subject of objective ethics is illusory. It's an illusion. I appreciate that when somebody says, love thy neighbor as thyself, they think they're referring above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, such reference is truly without foundation. Morality, just an aid to survival and reproduction, and has no being beyond or without this. Jean-Paul Sartre, atheist, philosopher. It's very distressing that God does not exist, because all possibility of finding values in a heaven of ideas disappears along with them. There can no longer be an a priori good, since there is no infinite and perfect consciousness to think it. C.S. Lewis, talking about before. He's a Christian. He says, you know, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. And some of you are like, yeah, that's my problem with God. How could God allow evil to exist? You're talking about good and evil. What kind of a God allows evil? Lewis is like, yeah, I used to think that too. But where did I get this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? We're using the morality that God built into us to tell God that he doesn't exist. That's what we're doing. It's actually a great explanation for the problem of evil. I wish I had time to go into it. But like most things in this lecture, I don't. So, but the fact that there even is a right and a wrong argues for God. I'll leave you with one final lengthy quote here from Arthur Allen Leff, professor of law at Yale. Wrote this article, kind of a famous article. He's an agnostic, and he's arguing, though, that unless God is the moral authority behind human law, the law is arbitrary and cannot survive the taunt, but says who? Israel and Palestine are arguing, and they're like, you can't do this, no, you can't do that, and they're like, well, says who? All international politics tend to run along these lines. No, this is ours. No, it's ours. Says who? Says me. Says me. War. And even the laws that we make in our country, it's like, okay, I mean, somebody came up with those, but I mean, really, what right did they have to come up with those? Says who? And he's just wrestling with, you know, the problem is, we're all a bunch of human beings on the same level trying to come up with objective moral standards. He says, you know, if the evaluation is to be beyond question, then the evaluator and its evaluated processes must be similarly insulated from human bias and the problems that come in when humans start to make up morality. He says, if it's to fulfill its role, the evaluator must be the unjudged judge, the unruled legislator, the premise maker who rests on no premises, the uncreated creator of values. Now, what would you call such a thing if it existed? You'd call it him. He says we need someone outside of this context to be our universal measuring rod, to be our standard for right and wrong. And he says, the problem is, all I can say is this, it looks as if we are all we have. He's like, there is no God, so we've got to somehow work this out, even though it's a hopeless task. Given what we know about ourselves and each other, this is an extraordinarily unappetizing prospect. Looking around the world, it appears that if all men are brothers, the ruling model is Cain and Abel. Neither reason, nor love, nor even terror seems to have worked to make us good, and worse than that, there's no reason why anything should. Only if ethics were something unspeakable by us could law be unnatural and therefore unchallengeable. As things stand now, everything is up for grabs. That's right. Without God, that's exactly the state we find ourselves in. And then he concludes his article this way. He says, nevertheless, napalming babies is bad. Starving the poor is wicked. Buying and selling each other is depraved. Those who stood up and died resisting Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Idi Amin, and Pol Pot, and General Custer, too, have earned salvation. And those who acquiesce deserve to be damned. There is, in the world, such a thing as evil. And then he says, all together now, says who? God help us. You see the problems you run into. How life is unlivable without God. Is there anything special about humans? The naturalist says no. God says, yeah. I made you in my image. There's everything special about you because you're made in my image. You're spiritual beings. You're not just physical. Am I really me? God says, yes. You're not just a series of chemical reactions. You're an eternal being. He says, you've never met a mere mortal. Every human being you interact with is an eternal being. Do I have the freedom to choose? Naturalism says no. God says, yeah, your choices are really important. You'll be evaluated. One day you're going to have to stand before me and answer for your choices. Is there such a thing as right and wrong? God says, yeah, I am Yahweh. And I've determined what's right and wrong. You should be different because I'm different. You need me to teach you my ways. And finally, does what I call love mean anything? Naturalism says no. God says, yeah. Love is actually the most important thing. The goal of life, to experience the love of God and then to respond by loving Him back and loving one another. Jesus says, those are the greatest commandments. There's a reason why you think love is special. It's because God has declared it that way. And ultimately, God loved you. He loved you so much that He sent His one and only Son. While you were His enemy, Christ died for you. And He's calling on you to respond to that. So in conclusion here, I've given you a few reasons. Not that many. But some pretty good ones, I think. But that's not enough. Reasons alone aren't enough. Remember, biblical faith, it's reason and then it's belief. It's stepping out, a step of faith based on those reasons. Until you take that step, you're not going to experience that certainty that God offers you. You're going to have to step out. You're going to have to take a risk here. You're going to have to do what Jesus talks about in Revelation 3, where He says, here I am. I stand at the door and knock at your heart. And He says, if anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and I will eat with him and he with me. You see, that's the problem in a lot of these cases here. The reason why in our minds we're setting up systems that exclude God is because we're terrified of God, because we know we're guilty. We know that universal sense of right and wrong. And we're terrified of what God would think about me if He was there. And God says, yes, I agree that you are guilty, and you're more than you even realize. But I've sent my Son. I'm offering grace. I love you. I'm offering forgiveness. You don't have to go through these mental gymnastics to deny me anymore because you're scared. Instead, you can turn and admit the thing you've been denying your whole life and open the door so I can come in and join you for sweet fellowship together. That's your next step tonight. Yeah, Lord, thanks that you've given us a value we didn't deserve, and you've given us a love that we didn't deserve. Thanks too, God, that we can actually have a rational basis for our faith, and that we don't have to just believe harder when we have doubts, but we can actually look at the truth and look at reality. And I pray, God, that those of us that have never taken that step of faith to come into a relationship with you, I pray at the very least that those people would look more into what evidence you do offer, that they would be willing to do some reading on that. But Lord, some of us here tonight, we've already had enough answers. And it's time to take that step. It's time to take that step of faith to open the door to our hearts, to tell you that we want your forgiveness. We want you to come in and to experience the sweet, sweet fellowship with you that you're offering. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.